I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to The Connection.
Mr. Chairman, there are only four kinds of people in the world. Those who have been caregivers, those who currently are caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregiving. That's all of us.
That was former First Lady Rosalynn Carter testifying in 2011 at a Senate Special Committee hearing on the Older Americans Act. Fast forward to today, and the country is on a collision course, driven by the growing number of people needing hands-on care, which can be expensive, and a severe shortage of workers to provide those services, many of whom are underpaid. That leaves millions of stressed-out and tapped-out families, some 20% of the population, who are providing unpaid care for their loved ones, emptying their bank accounts and maxing out their credit cards. TV 12 is airing a PBS documentary, Caregiving, on June 24th about this crisis, how we got here and how to address it. Here's Malcoma Brown Ekeogu, who we meet in the documentary, caring for her husband, who was diagnosed with a severe neurological disorder.
Now I'm doing total care, helping him to walk, cleaning him, bathing him.
Thank God for your feet, right? You can walk.
The entire process has been mentally draining, physically draining.
One more. Yeah.
To the point that I could no longer work.
Okay, Kent. Insulin time.
It took everything that we had left. My credit card debt went from maybe $2,000 to over $30,000.
You ready?
Mm-hmm. The journey's been tough, but it made me fall more in love with him.
Lay back. Mm-hmm. I got you. Lay back.
Even though he was disappearing, it's like our love was growing.
We recently screened a portion of the caregiving film and hosted a series of discussions for and about caregivers at WHYY. Today on The Connection, we feature selections from those interviews and begin with Barak Goodman. He's the producer of Caregiving, co-founder of ARC Media, and he's won numerous awards for his work, including a Peabody, Emmy, and DuPont Columbia.
One of the points in the film is clearly whether it's care provided in the home or at a facility somewhere, is it seen as women's work? As someone who's been so intimately involved in that,
yeah.
Is that how you see it?
Not at all. In fact, I am personally going through it. You know, since this began, my father and my mother, mostly my father, has declined precipitously. And, you know, this is the thing about caregiving. It's someone else's problem until it's yours, and then it's overwhelming. Yeah. The minute it becomes yours, it becomes overwhelming. And you realize, where was I? Why didn't I know about this? Where are the choices? What do I do? I am super fortunate to have resources and to have a lot of help. And nevertheless, it's an overwhelming experience emotionally, physically, and so forth. I don't think it's just women's work. It's defaulted to women because of these ridiculous traditional stereotypes. But, you know, many men, myself, but many, many men become caregivers as well. I think it naturally, women are very nurturing, and that sometimes tips it a little bit, but it really shouldn't be seen that way.
Since you mentioned it, I mean, what's this been like for you to see what your father is going through?
I mean, completely eye-opening in both great ways and very negative ways. The great ways are that you develop a whole new relationship with a person you're caring for. It's a role reversal. That's the sort of cheap way of putting it, but it's much more than that. I think we were talking about how you discover new ways of loving this person, new features. My father, who is this ferocious intellectual, a professor of law at Penn for decades, is now almost childlike, and I've become almost parental. It's beautiful. On the negative side, there just are too few resources. There's no place to put him. As Malcoma said, they have to get so sick to get any kind of help. You know, it's absurd. And there just aren't enough choices, aren't enough places to go for help. You have to work your way into the system. And that's really disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, we see, and I think anyone that has done this work, that the intimacy,
yeah.
the caring, the physicality of it, the washing of the body, feeding, dressing, clothing. It's. I mean, we do that for babies at birth, and we do that for people in need.
Definitely. And you know, life at that time of your life narrows to almost infinitesimally small, you know, set of concerns, your bodily functions, your food, your medication. And we as caregivers also become narrowed in those moments to those things. And we have to change the diapers and, you know, even for our parents. And yet it's also vast and an enlarging experience. As you heard in these clips, I think Malcolm said, I'm falling more in love. And it's so kind of, you know, sort of unexpected, but it happens. It ennobles and enlarges your soul at the same time as your actual tasks are becoming these very mundane things. So it's this curious experience, you know.
I also really appreciate putting this whole very intimate caregiving into this historical political context. I mean, beginning with the New Deal and the Social Security Act, where government really, maybe for the first time, really intervened in people's lives to help get them out of poverty or get them through some kind of a crisis. And, you know, Frances Perkins deserves a face on Mount Rushmore,
she really does.
As the Secretary of Labor. I love that she was a social worker. And, of course, a social worker would know what people need.
She asked, you know, it's such an obvious thing to say, but yet needs to be said. She said, maybe government's role is to help people's lives be better.
Right.
What a concept.
You know?
And yet it was sort of revolutionary. I mean, she is in many ways the architect of that whole idea. And now that idea is absolutely under threat. And I think we've sort of lost the threat of that. But she realized that government has a role to play in people's intimate lives, and a remarkable woman, truly.
And I think elder poverty was, you know, cut dramatically just with the, and she did it in 6 months, you know.
Amazing.
With the establishment of Social Security.
Yeah.
It is interesting, and we can't do justice to this history about how it toggles back and forth.
Right.
Things are given, and then they're taken away. We've got Johnson and the war on poverty with Medicare and Medicaid. Then you've got Reagan taking back, and then you've got the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then the back and forth that goes as if this country cannot figure out what to do about caregiving.
And it's not just partisan. I mean, you know, Clinton, you know, ended welfare as we know it, and it was Joe Manchin, proud Democrat in quotes, who torpedoed Biden's Build Back Better bill. And you know, so yes, it falls more in terms of party, but there has been this tension in this country between the idea of government helping people and the idea that this is should be private and should be the responsibility of mostly women. And it really is sort of ugly, and we don't need to look at it, and like we certainly don't need to pay for it. And so there's been this tension, and it does toggle back and forth, and we have not figured it out. Other countries have much better than we have, and they have a better quality of life as a result.
And just because Build Back Better, this was under the Biden administration, was to include caregiving as kind of part of the infrastructure.
Yeah, right.
Besides putting in, you know, things for electric vehicles, we were going to help support caregivers. Go ahead.
Just because it is infrastructure, it enables people to live better lives, to be more productive. It helps the economy. It is like building a, you know, fiber optic cable line in some ways. Like you solve this problem, you free people to go back and be productive in their daily lives. And Ai-Jean Poo makes this point in the film in a part we didn't see. But, you know, it's folly to purely from an economic free market point of view, it's folly to not address this issue.
And she, for everyone, is a leader in this whole caregiving movement. So what do you want people to take away from this film? I mean, I cried. I got really angry. What do you want us to do?
I mean, ideally, there is some movement in terms of public policy. That's a hard thing to ask for at the moment. But little things. For example, in the state of Rhode Island right now, there is a program, a mandate, that kids are asked if they are caregivers. And if they are, they are provided extra support by the schools. Something as small as that. You know, it just doesn't require, you know, some vast socialist takeover of government. Small things can make a big difference. Really small things. Little packages, you know, once you qualify for hospice. Hospice is a godsend. I can tell that personally in our case, but you could see it in the film. Hospice, if it could be guaranteed and expanded just a little bit, it just transforms the experience. And so, again, it's not massive transformation. It's, to begin with, small steps, I think.
Yeah. There's a father-husband in this documentary caring for his wife, and he uses social media. I mean, he turns to the internet to find support, to vent whatever his feelings were, but created a community for himself.
Yeah, that guy, Matt, is a great character, and you feel the isolation he felt. In that case, his wife was a young woman who had a couple of strokes because of ovarian cancer, and he suddenly had to quit his job. But his entire life was turned upside down. They had a small child, and he's not a perfect hero. He raged. He got upset. He did turn to social media and screamed and yelled and. Right. And he was not easy to work with.
No, I can't.
He was a little bit, he's a kind of bitter guy. But on the other hand, it's heroic what he's done. Now his wife is doing so much better than anyone thought she would.
Good.
And his son is thriving. And, you know, he spilled a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but it's paid off for him.
I know this film was made before what's happening to a lot of the safety net today.
Yeah.
I saw that there were at least plans, I don't know if it happened or not, to get rid of Meals on Wheels.
Yeah.
The SNAP program. I mean, these are the most sort of basic care that people need, and to think that they might be on the chopping block.
The social safety net is being shred, and I don't think people realize it yet. I don't think the impact has been felt. And it's not like Trump voters don't also need this stuff.
Yeah.
And I, again, not trying to be partisan here, but I do hope that if that impact is felt, some of these decisions will be reversed.
Right.
And in fact, maybe the pendulum will swing in the other direction. That's a maybe naive view, but who knows?
Right.
You never know.
Well, it has swung before, hasn't
it? It has swung before, indeed.
Well, Barak Goodman,
thank you so much
for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Barak Goodman at a recent event at WHYY. The PBS documentary he produced, Caregiving, airs on Tuesday night, June 24th on TV12. Coming up, a daughter pays tribute to her mother, who challenged stereotypes about disabilities to win back custody of her child. On The Connection today, the crisis in caregiving and what to do about it. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane. Today on The Connection, we're talking about the crisis in caregiving, the growing need for care, the high cost of care, and the shortage of care workers. It's the subject of a PBS documentary, Caregiving, that airs next Tuesday night, June 24th on TV12. Millions of Americans, about 20% of the population, are caregivers for their families, which can be emotionally and financially overwhelming. Some 5 million children and teenagers are providing direct care for members of their family. Here's Jacob, profiled in the documentary, who's been helping to care for his mother, who has MS.
Can you open this?
I could try.
I've always been a big help. I make sure that she takes her medicine. If my mom ever needs help cooking, I'm her hand.
Jacob, these my hands, because I don't feel my fingers anymore.
Now you make the balls.
When I'm able to get my infusion, I will be feeling a trillion times better.
All right, I'm gonna go lay down.
All right.
I love you.
Feel better, okay?
Okay, thank you for cooking.
You're welcome. And I'm not complaining because I'm glad that I'm a caregiver. I'm glad that I'm able to help my family.
How long they put him in for?
10 minutes, flip him, 10 minutes.
Decades ago in Philadelphia, Celestine Tate Harrington, who was born unable to use her arms and legs, lost custody of her daughter because the Department of Public Welfare said she was incapable of taking care of her child. Celestine went to court and won back custody by demonstrating to the judge that she could take care of her child, not like other parents. Celestine raised two daughters and supported her family as a street musician. Her daughter, Nia Tate Ball, is executive producer of The Celestine Tate Harrington Story, a documentary that aired last year on PBS. Nia joined us at the recent caregiving event at WHYY to talk about her mother and their relationship.
Trailblazer. She would not take no for an answer, as you can see in the film. Just a woman filled with love, power, ferocity. There was just no quit in her. And so as a result of her being who she was, we are all now who we are.
Let me talk just a little bit about your mother, and then we'll talk about the sort of caregiving part of your story. So she was born in 1955, and she did not have the use of her arms and legs. So something had happened to create that. Do you know?
Not really. I don't really know the full story of that. But yes, when she was born, she had arms and legs. They were just kind of deformed. And so she didn't have the ability to use her arms or her legs. And she was born that way.
Did she go to school? No, this was, she was born in 1955.
In the 50s, yeah. So she did. She did go to school, not traditional school. She went to school for handicapped children. She also attended the English House and other school. She called them, considered them schools, but she didn't have any formal education at all. So
when you were born, the Department of Public Welfare decided, that your mother could not take care of you.
Yep.
They took you from her.
Had absolutely nothing to do with her ability to care for me. I wasn't being neglected. None of that was happening. They just felt that, you know, they made the decision that because she was disabled that they could come into our home and take me. And so it was a very difficult time for my whole entire family. But, you know, if you can imagine what life must have been like her before I was born, right? You probably never think that you're going to get married. You don't feel normal. You don't feel like, you know, you'll ever be accepted by society. And then you have a baby that you fall in love with. And I was 6 months old when they came into the home.
So well, I was wondering how old you were. So.
Yeah, they didn't take me immediately. So 6 months later after, you know, getting to know this baby and falling in love with this baby, they come in and they just, you know, took me out of the home. And
where did you go? Do you know?
They had me with, first I was in, you know, down at DHS, wherever they take those children. I really don't know. And then I was with a family very shortly during the court proceedings. But the thing about it is I had a family,
right?
You know, I had my grandparents, I had my aunts, I had my uncles, we had a support system. So that's why we kind of feel like it was targeted. She was, you know, kind of targeted for her condition. But, so she went to court. Presiding was Judge Edward Rosenberg, who was also a force
of nature.
a force of nature, but also a very kind heart. I had the pleasure of linking up with him much later in life.
That's nice.
Just to thank him for making the decision that he made. And
well, she took on DPW. She said, "I want my daughter back."
Oh, she did. She went to court and literally changed my diaper with her mouth. In the courtroom.
And that was sort of like, can you take care of this child? And this
watch
was,
this.
And she said, well, and
oh,
you,
yes.
Yeah.
But my mother was always very theatrical. That's where we all get it from. And so she said, you know, if you want a show, I'm going to give you one. But no, that was her way of showing the world that she could do anything than any other mother could do. She just had to do it differently. And it's just like, you know, with education, we all learn differently. We all do things differently. And when you are born with a disability, you may not be able to do things the way other people do things, but it doesn't mean that you're not capable or able to do it. And she just went to court and just proved that fact.
She was also very media savvy. She kind of knew how to play the media, if I can put it that way.
She was an influencer before influencers were influencers. I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
And what occurred is she leveraged the Jet magazine and other media sources in order to, you know, get publicity in order to get me back. And it was the people of the city of Philadelphia who knew she received a raw deal. And so when you have enough people rallying behind you and speaking up for you and campaigning for you, you know, she just needed that energy behind her, and she did what she needed to do. And Judge Edward Rosenberg, literally, the other day somebody sent me some audio of the action of her in the courtroom. Like, I'm about to be 50 years old. All of these years later, and to hear my mother's voice and hear her advocate. So my mother has since passed away, and we may get to that. But to hear her advocating for me all that long ago, and it was just something to hear.
Yeah. So you're a child.
Mm-hmm.
So she won custody. Being raised by your mom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So help us understand, the back and forth caregiving that happened. With
absolutely.
You and your mom.
So it was not an easy thing. So if you think about it, she won, so she could not lose in front of people, right? So she couldn't always share that she needed help, and wouldn't always share that she needed support, because she was afraid that if she showed the least bit of vulnerability, that I would be taken again.
Right.
And so a lot of times, you know, we lived in circumstances where, you know, it was very difficult. You know, my mother was charged with caring for me as the mother, but from my earliest memories, I was the caregiver to her.
Right.
Yeah. And so Jacob, hence, you know,
the young boy in the film.
Yeah, Jacob in the film, I just resonated with him so much, because you want the source of normalcy. People think that because you have a parent with a disability or a parent that's ill or sick, that there's something wrong with you. You know what I mean? And then even, you know, going to school and getting on the school bus, there were times when I was late to school or absent from school a lot. And most people assume automatically that that's just neglect, or, you know, they just didn't get this kid to school on time. But there were so many different circumstances going on at home that required me to care for her. If she had a doctor's appointment, a lot of times we would go, you know, bathing her, dressing her. You know, I had to learn how to take care of her feminine hygiene.
Right.
And I'm a little girl learning these things. And so, you know, I just, but it's normal. You know, it's not like we're trying to do it or you're in a role. You are living life like you know it.
I mean, did you say to yourself, my mom is disabled? How did you think about her?
I
feel like she didn't think of herself as having a disability.
She never did, honestly. She had an uncanny knack to be able to make us feel powerful and normal and just in the moment, right? And so, like, learning to dress her legs were kind of contorted. So everything she taught us in a game, right? Or if we had to go to the grocery store, she would teach us in a song, right? So I had to go to the grocery store and I had to remember the list, right? So we would learn that in a song. My mother could type 45 words a minute with her mouth. My mother could sew. My mother pierced my ears.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
But I don't know. Who's here dated enough to know back in the day when they would put a needle through the ear?
Yeah.
And then after they put a needle through the ear, they'd take a little piece of the broomstick off. Right. Yeah, this is so unsanitary now that I think about it. But all of this.
You survived.
I lived. But my mother was able to do all of those things. And, you know, some of the things that I can remember, you know, when it came to caregiving is, you know, learning to cook, right? Yeah. So spaghetti was my first meal to learn to cook. And you would you can't imagine how many pots of spaghetti ended up on the floor, right? They call me clumsy to this day. But it was because I was learning at such a young age to do it. But now I'm a phenomenal cook.
I bet. I mean, as a child, did you resent this? Were there times when you just wanted to live like other children? Did you allow yourself that?
No, because other children wanted to be me. Like,
there you go.
But, well, you know what? My mom, that's what I'm saying. Like, we never knew that we were not like everybody else. It was just natural. We just were who we were. And my mother was a source of a resource for other people, honestly. And she was an advocate for disabilities, you know, way back when. And so people often reached out to her for resources. Sometimes I felt like she was too available to other people, right? But that was her calling. And then as a caregiver, what ultimately happens with caregivers, and I see it as I look at certain individuals in my family, is once you become a caregiver, you can't turn it off, right? And so
I hear some yeses in the audience.
You start caregiving even when people don't need care. And
how about taking care of yourself?
Oh, and then you never do that,
right?
Because you are so conditioned to care and take care of everybody else that you often leave yourself as last.
Your mom was a musician. She was a street performer. She played a keyboard.
Yes, she did.
With her, I guess, her tongue and
her
mouth. And for a time, she went to Atlantic City where she performed on the boardwalk there. And
absolutely,
according to this documentary, she was making $1,000 a day?
At times. I feel like...
That's a lot of money.
Listen, my mother was honestly an entrepreneur. We heard in this story so many individuals that faced financial insecurity, housing insecurities, you know, not being able to pay your bills, not being able to make ends meet. And just like everybody else, we face that too. But my mother was determined not to fully depend on, you know, the resources that just were not readily there. And so, you know, in the summer times, you know, Memorial Day weekend, she would clean up. Yes, she would. But she saw what she was doing as working. She felt like that was her work. That was her job. And I'm going to tell you something. On those days on that boardwalk in Atlantic City, my mother served so many people. She inspired so many people. People walking up and down that boardwalk, having just gone in the casino and probably lost every dime they had, came out with a woe is me kind of thing. What am I going to do? How am I going to survive? How am I going to move forward with life? And she would speak to everyday people and inspire them to continue putting one foot in front of the other. Why? Because they had feet.
Yeah.
She was the epitome of gratitude and grace. And so for us, and the way we looked at that, that was service. And a lot of people that encountered her, they would tell you, they would leave a conversation from my mother feeling like they could conquer the world.
Wow.
Because if you are in that condition, if you are disabled like that, and you are able to get up every single day and smile and care for people and take care of people and help people, then there is no reason why an able-bodied person should not do the same. And so that's just who she was and how
yeah.
she...
And she wrote a memoir.
She did.
She wrote a book. And in this documentary, it's wonderful, Howard Stern interviews her.
She got with Howard, didn't she?
I mean, that she disarmed him and charmed
really
him.
She really did. She really did. She had a way of working a room. My mother could identify the strengths, the weaknesses of every person that she encountered, and she knew how to play that.
And Celestine, now you've written this book. Now, how did you write the book? You didn't literally type it with your tongue, did you?
Yes, I did.
Now, get out of here. You're kidding me.
Typeset and everything.
But you have no arms or legs.
I have them. I just can't use them. I brought your book and I'm going to sign it for you.
Well, you know how to work a room.
You know, hearing you talk and also looking at watching the documentary, I was wondering if she were alive today and had to testify at a congressional committee, like what would happen?
Okay. So she'd start with this very infant-like, angelic voice, right? She would charm the pants off of the people, right? And they would get them to a point where they're kind of feeling sorry for her. And then she would nail them, honestly. And she would, you know, just with her mouth, with her words, with her voice, speak to the disadvantages and speak to, you know, and she would make them feel ashamed at, you know, the lack of resources and the lack of support for caregivers and for individuals with disabilities. But at the same time, she would encourage them.
Right.
And inspire them and urge them. She had a way of literally urging people to do the right thing.
Wow. When did she die then? How long ago was that?
So I count this up by my daughter's age. Every time Celeste turns another year, it's another year that my mom's been gone. And so she passed away in 1998. She was in a car accident.
Oh.
Mom had finally gotten her independence. And so she got a motorized gurney. And she was hit by a cab.
Yeah, oh, I'm so
and that
sorry.
Knocked her into a car. And so she lived for 6 days. And then... like on the sixth day, I went in and, you know, had a conversation with her. And I told her, you know, this is too hard and too difficult. I'm okay. You did your job.
Oh, wow.
I got it. I'll take it from here. And, yeah, so now we're continuing her legacy on. But the interesting thing is, right before my mom passed away, we lived in so many different places that didn't have, you know, heat. We had to put water on the stove to boil it, to have hot water at times. And so toward the end of her life, we didn't know this was going to be the end, but she purchased a condominium, two of them. And this is what sparked the real estate bug in me. I watched my mother purchase two condos, and then I watched my aunt purchase a duplex. And after I watched the two of them, I said, wait a minute. So I looked at my husband. I said, honey, this might be something we need to do. And so since then, we started, you know, working in real estate and building, you know, a real estate empire, essentially.
Right. Well, you do your mother proud.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was Nia Tate Ball talking about her mother, who defied stereotypes about disabilities to raise Nia and her sister. This interview was part of a caregiving event at WHYY in conjunction with a new PBS documentary, Caregiving, that airs on TV12 on June 24th. Coming up, why care workers are underpaid and what to do about it. You're listening to The Connection on WHYY.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
I'm Marty Moscoane, and today in The Connection, we're talking about the joys, the intimate connections, as well as the stresses of caring for ailing and aging family members. There's a growing demand for care and a shrinking care workforce, which means that families, often raising kids and holding down jobs, have to pick up the slack. It can be emotionally and financially draining. It's the subject of a new PBS documentary called Simply Caregiving, which will air Tuesday night on TV12. Joining us now is Ai Jen Poo, president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, representing home care workers, many of whom are stuck in poverty because of their low wages. This is another piece of this critical story. You know, crisis is an overused word. We use it a lot to describe problems, both big and small. That said, do we have a crisis in caregiving today? Is it a new crisis, or is it a longstanding problem that we just haven't addressed?
It is a crisis that has been simmering for decades, but it's been exacerbated and it's about to intensify. Because demographically, we have 10,000 of us every day turning 65 in America, and we're living longer than ever before, thanks to advances in healthcare and technology. So the number of people over the age of 85 will double by the year 2040. And I think all of us are feeling it in a way where we all have someone we know or love who needs care and is really struggling to afford or manage it. And we have not at all adapted our systems or our policies to support caregiving and quality of life for the longer lifespan that we now have. We've basically added an entire generation onto our lifespan in this country without adapting any of our systems or our policies or our culture to support the care we'll need for a longer lifespan.
I'm thinking, too, of the largely underpaid caregivers. Do we have a shortage of caregivers?
We do. We have what many are calling a workforce crisis where the median income of a home care worker, for example, is $22,000 per year.
Wow.
Workforce is underpaid, and we are talking about people who are mostly primary income earners for their families, but really struggle to make ends meet, to take care of themselves and their own families on that kind of income. And so you often see some of our most dedicated caregivers pushed out of the workforce into other low-wage service jobs like fast food or retail, where they can earn $5, $6 more per hour doing work that is, you know, obviously dignified and valuable, but we are in such a dire need of caregivers that home care, for example, is the fastest growing occupation in our entire workforce in this country because of the huge demand. And so we're having this workforce need and demand is exploding, and we have already a 26% turnover rate because the wages are so low.
Thinking about money, I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about a service that families largely can't afford to pay for.
Right.
And we've got care workers who are, as you say, making a median income of $22,000, which they cannot live on. So where does the money go? I mean, we've got families that are under so much stress trying to figure out how to provide support for an aging or ailing parent, let's say. And then you've got caregivers who can barely make a living.
It's a huge problem, generations in the making, that has to do with the fact that we have never as a country invested in our ability for working class and middle class families to afford care. And that's across the board. That's child care. That's even, we are one of the only countries in the entire world that has no federal paid family and medical leave program. We have no long-term care program. And we have been told, we have sort of internalized a story that caregiving is a personal, individual responsibility to be shouldered in the privacy of our homes, mostly by women, as opposed to a collective national priority that we should, in modern American life today, be able to count on the ability to have access to care while we work. And the fact that we've never invested in a long-term care program or paid leave just means that we force families into impossible choices. They're having to choose between work and caring for a loved one who really needs them, or, you know, whether to have children or not. A lot of people are facing really tough, impossible choices that really they should not be facing in a country with as many resources as we have. And we should not have a workforce in our care economy, whether it's childcare or direct care, that is forced to live in poverty while working incredibly hard to support us.
I mean, it's so interesting to compare and contrast the beginning and the end of life and this need for care. And it's something that is going to touch us. This documentary that's going to air on PBS is all about the fact that at some point we're going to need care, or we're going to be giving care, or some version of that. And yet, it feels like a kind of strange denial, that we just deny that we're going to be old and vulnerable, or deny that we're going to get some kind of disability and we're going to need some kind of care.
It's true. We've culturally resisted the idea of aging, whereas actually, truthfully, if we're lucky, we're all aging.
Exactly. Right at this very moment. Exactly.
And so there, especially with such a large and growing, I mean, the baby boomer generation is the generation that's aging into retirement right now. And so this makes me hopeful, I have to say, because the boomer generation is a generation, talk about a culture shifting generation. This is the generation that gave us rock and roll and social justice. I mean, if they
welcome.
Can't change. Yeah, thank you. If y'all can't change the way that we value and support caregiving and the way that we approach and embrace aging in America, I don't know who can. So I'm counting on y'all.
And there are a lot of us. It is also interesting to look at this documentary and seeing how the country over generations has really seesawed between government supporting safety programs like the creation of the Social Security Department and then taking away some of those safety net features, this sort of back and forth between giving and taking away. How do you see that? How do you understand that?
There's a few different ways that I understand it. One is that our approach to basic human needs and what is an economic issue and need versus what isn't is just outdated. The days where we could assume there would be an adult in the household, specifically a woman, who would be available to take care of a disabled loved one or an aging parent or a child, those days have been long gone. And in many working class and working poor communities, they never existed. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is that we have been in a struggle about what is the appropriate role of government. And I would say that part of the reason why care has gotten embroiled and is kind of being pulled back and forth in this debate is because of our failure to really recognize how essential access to care is from an economic standpoint. If we don't have the ability to take care of our families, all of us workers who power the economy are part of families. And if we don't have assistance and programs or policies that enable us to both work and take care of our families, then it is a huge economic problem. It is a problem in terms of people being able to participate in the workforce. It is a problem in terms of people sustaining in the workforce and also having capital to spend in the economy to create economic activity. And so only now are we starting to realize that care is not just a nice to have soft issue. It's not about big government. It's actually about the foundation of a healthy economy and a healthy society, in ways that really I can't think of anything that would be more fundamental to our health and well-being as a country.
Should we think of it like bridges and roads, that this is part of our infrastructure?
Yes. I think Senator Casey from Pennsylvania, former Senator Casey, he said it best on the Senate floor a year and a half ago. He said, you know, some people need a bridge or a tunnel to get to work, and others need home care. And others need childcare. And I think that crystallizes it in a nutshell.
I wonder, we're obviously watching as the Trump administration promotes plans to cut Medicaid, which funds programs for low-income people, low-income families, for the elderly as well. Assuming that the money is taken away at the level that they're talking about, billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars, what do you anticipate happening when it comes to things like caregiving?
It is a disaster what they're proposing, almost $800 billion in cuts to the Medicaid program, which is twice what we were proposing Congress actually invest in Medicaid just a couple years ago to strengthen access. Right now, we have 700,000 people who are on a waiting list for Medicaid home care, Medicaid home and community-based services. And these are people with disabilities, older adults, and their families who are eligible for Medicaid services but can't get access to them because of the program is so underfunded. Okay, so now that's with the funding that we currently have for Medicaid. Demand continues to rise, and this Congress is talking about cutting almost $800 billion. That kind of money, there is no way states can make up for that kind of a gap in your state budget. In some states, Medicaid is a third of the budget, and so if a huge portion of their state budget gets gutted, everything is impacted. Public education, transportation, everything that gets funded in a state budget is going to be under unprecedented pressure. And specifically when it comes to caregiving, rural hospitals are hanging on by a thread as it stands. And there's been a rash of rural hospital closings in the last decade because of lack of funding. And many of them relied on Medicaid for their primary income source. And many will close, if not most. And then there's the question of rural nursing homes. And those nursing homes are almost entirely dependent on Medicaid funding. Wow. People will lose the only care they have access to in rural communities. I just can't overstate how devastating this will be. And when I think about what my grandparents, what my parents deserve at end of life, the idea that they wouldn't even have access to a nursing home, it's just the cruelty and the absurdity of it, and the human cost of it will be devastating.
Indeed, and so dire. And even just to add to that, as you're saying that this is low-wage work, I know from some personal experience that I see a number of clearly immigrants who are working in the care industry. We now see that ICE is going into workplaces looking for people to deport. Are you concerned that some of these workers are going to be tossed out of the country?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So this is the other irony of it all. Here you have a big, ugly budget bill that is going to cut Medicaid, take away our health care and our long-term care. And by the way, Medicaid pays for 70% of the home care workforce. So we're also talking about jobs at stake. It's going to destroy jobs in order to pay for human rights abuses against immigrants. And a third of the direct care workforce is immigrant.
Yeah.
So in this anemic, underfunded care system that we have, one of the only lifelines has been immigrant workers. And without them, the whole thing collapses.
I was thinking 5 years ago, in the start of the pandemic, people would applaud care workers, healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, and care workers working in hospitals, because they were literally risking their lives to save our lives. And now we're talking about making these dramatic, draconian cuts to our healthcare system. Do you think we need to go sort of to the edge of the cliff before we bring about some kind of reforms that would bring, as you say, some kind of dignity to the kind of care that we give to people at the end of life?
I'm not one of the people who believes in burning things down in order to build them back up. People with disabilities who rely on these services in order to get out of bed, mm-hmm. in order to live a full life in the community, in order to go to school, to work, without these services, they will end up in institutions. This is really a life and death dire situation. And I have to believe that we can come together to stop these cuts and at the same time know that what we have to build is so much greater than what we have. And the thing that gives me hope is that I think about the 6 million direct care workers who are out there, despite being underpaid and overworked. They're out there every day showing up and caring for the people that we love. And I think about the 105.6 million family caregivers who just every day, with their empathy and their energy and their enthusiasm and effort, they make it possible for so many other people to have dignity and care when they need it. And if we all come together, it's an unstoppable force for change. I mean, that is a huge number of people. And so I think I have to believe that number of people coming together can make anything possible. And that generationally, given the pressures on families, that this is the moment. We are the generation who can do it.
Ajahn Pooh, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ai Jen Poo, president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She's featured in the PBS documentary Caregiving that airs Tuesday night, June 24th on TV 12. And that's it for today's edition of The Connection. The engineers for the caregiving event at WHYY and this program, Diana Martinez, Paul Parmalee, John Kelsey, and Ben Call. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. The Connection airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Thanks again for joining us.